From Kentucky to Nevada, Indiana to South Dakota, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, it is called the International Criminal Court, and the Trump administration is rejecting its jurisdiction over the United States. Brett Schaefer of the Heritage Foundation is here with details. Brett Kavanaugh's hearings are over, and he appears headed for confirmation. But there will be political fallout for vulnerable Democratic senators. Andy Roth of the Club for Growth has the real story. The Supreme Court has ruled labor unions cannot force public employees to pay dues or fair share fees. But some unions seem to have not gotten the message. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine reports. And be it protests at Supreme Court confirmation hearings, taking a knee at football games, or setting your sneakers on fire, Colin Hanna says, lighten up, America, on this week's American Radio Journal Commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. President Trump's National Security Advisor John Bolton this past week unleashed a blistering attack on the International Criminal Court and said it has no authority over the United States. Here to explain what the court is and why Ambassador Bolton has taken such a strong stance is Brett Schaefer. Brett is the J. Kingham Fellow in International Relations at the Heritage Foundation. Brett, welcome to American Radio Journal. Brett, we're going to talk today about the International Criminal Court. I would suspect an organization that most of our listeners have never heard of or about. Tell us a bit about the International Criminal Court. What is it? What is its intended function?
The International Criminal Court is an international judicial organization. It was set up under the auspices of the Rome Statute for the International Criminal Court, which is an international treaty. And the court was actually stood up as an institution in 2002, and its responsibilities are to prosecute war crimes, crimes against humanity, and genocide. And more recently, it was also given authority to prosecute the crime of aggression for member states, and also in some cases against non-member states if they are referred to the court by the UN Security Council. If those states request ICC investigation into matters occurring within its jurisdiction, or if the alleged crimes occur within the territory of a member state. So it is an institution that has a very broad mandate in some respects, but very narrow in the types of crimes that it can actually pursue.
What is the United States' role in this, and how did we come about being a part of it?
Well, that's the thing. We've never actually been a part of it. When the Rome Statute was being negotiated in the 1990s, the United States was a fairly enthusiastic supporter of the notion behind the International Criminal Court. The U.S. had been instrumental in the Nuremberg trials after World War II. The U.S. had been instrumental in setting up the Yugoslavian Tribunal and the Rwandan Tribunal. And as a country, we are very supportive of the idea that those who commit serious crimes like these should be held to account. But we're also concerned about some aspects of the Rome Statute when it was being drafted. For instance, we wanted the court to have a fairly restricted trigger mechanism, meaning that there should be a freewheeling international judicial authority able to act without any kind of external check on it in ways that could be disruptive to international peace and security, or could lead in some ways to aggravate situations rather than to alleviate them. And in 1998, when the Rome Statute was finalized, the United States under the Clinton administration actually voted against the adoption of that Rome Statute. And President Clinton didn't sign the Rome Statute until the very last day it was possible to sign it, and he only did so because he wanted the United States to be able to engage in negotiations on amendments to potentially fix the flaws that he saw were evident in the treaty. President Bush tried to get some of those concerns addressed. He was unsuccessful in doing that. Congress also had a number of different concerns about the ICC, and they passed something called the American Service Members Protection Act, which very strongly limited U.S. cooperation with the International Criminal Court and authorized the president to free U.S. persons if they ever did come under the custody of the International Criminal Court. And the Obama administration also, during its time, never sought ratification of the Rome Statute, never sought to remove or eliminate any of those Article 98 agreements because it too recognized the potential threat that the ICC posed to U.S. interests in freedom of action abroad. The Trump administration's recent action is not so much a break or a deviation or a radical departure from U.S. policy. It's actually a continuation of, and perhaps in some ways, a return to policy under the Bush administration in terms of the U.S. approach to the court and the level of U.S. cooperation with the court.
Now, Brett, let's talk a bit about the Trump administration's reaction or recent action. And that's why we're talking about it right now, is because Ambassador Bolton, who is now part of the Trump administration, had some very definitive statements to make about the International Criminal Court this past week. What did the ambassador have to say?
Well, the ambassador essentially said that the United States will not cooperate with court, the United States will not support the court, and the United States will not in any way support the court in its endeavors. And the triggering mechanism for this, or the reason why the ambassador took such a strong stance, is because of the actions of the court itself. Last November, the prosecutor for the ICC announced that she was seeking to launch a formal investigation into war crimes and crimes against humanity committed by U.S. soldiers and U.S. government officials related to the war in Afghanistan. And when that happened, in essence, the administration was forced to respond. And they said that this is in essence, a critical shift in our relationship with the ICC, that we reject this effort by the court. And we reject it not because we want to be held unaccountable for anything that happened in the conduct of that war, but because we've actually investigated those and in many cases held those individuals to account and punished them for the acts that they've committed. The court itself is supposed to be acting under a principle of complementarity, which means that it's a court of last resort, not first resort, and that countries that are willing and able to investigate crimes that have been committed by their citizens or the people under their authority should be allowed to do so. And so the court is fully aware of that, the extent to which the United States has gone to investigate these matters and the extent to which we have held individuals account. But nonetheless, due to political pressures, the court felt it necessary that they were going to launch their own investigation nonetheless. And the U.S. is taking appropriate action to end U.S. cooperation for a court that is acting in a political manner and to protect U.S. persons from the jurisdiction of a court which we have never actually agreed should have any jurisdiction over our people at all.
We have been talking with Brett Schaefer, and Brett is the J. Kingham Fellow in International Regulatory Affairs with the Heritage Foundation. Brett, tell us just a bit more about the Heritage Foundation, where folks can go to read your recent article commenting on Ambassador Bolton's remarks and other items that you have written.
The Heritage Foundation is a conservative public policy think tank in Washington, D.C. If your listeners are interested in reading more about the ICC and our work in that area, they can go to www.heritage.org, or they can also go to the Daily Signal, which is an outlet affiliated with the Heritage Foundation and publishes articles and opinion pieces on public policy matters.
Again, we have been talking with Brett Schaefer. He's with the Heritage Foundation. Brett, thank you for taking time to be with us today.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Andy Roth at the Club for Growth, like all of us, has been keeping an eye on the confirmation process for Supreme Court Justice nominee Brett Kavanaugh. We're going to talk about that and the political implications today. Andy, good to have you here.
Hi, thanks for having me, Loman.
Well, as you're out traveling around the country, I know you've been keeping a close eye on U.S. Senate races. We're going to get into a few of them specifically in a couple of minutes. But just generally, Andy, your thoughts on the fact that the Kavanaugh hearings are now concluded. What does the schedule look like? And is it possible that this new justice could be seated before the Supreme Court begins its new term in October?
Yes, in fact, that is the goal. These hearings have devolved down to basically a circus where the Democrats just scream for a few days, and Kavanaugh unfortunately has to sit through that and answer their questions. And then now that they've concluded, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell wants to schedule a floor vote. It could happen very early, but the Democrats do have some procedural tools at their disposal to drag it out a little bit further. So I anticipate that Kavanaugh will get voted on in the Senate the week of the 24th of September. And once he gets confirmed, which he will, then he'll be seated before the October Supreme Court session that you mentioned.
In terms of the confirmation vote, it now, of course, takes only a simple majority as a result of the so-called nuclear option to lower it from a two-thirds to a simple majority occurred with the last candidate who was nominated to the post. So as we look at this, in terms of the Republicans, there are 51 Republicans. Are they united on this confirmation vote?
Yeah, they are. In fact, there were only 50 Republicans until recently, but John Kyle got appointed and sworn in to replace John McCain in Arizona. So you're right, there are 51. It appears that all 51 are supportive of Kavanaugh. But the more interesting question is how many Democrats are going to support him, if any. And those Democrats are likely going to be from red states, especially red states where they're up for re-election. But there is one who is not up for re-election that could very likely support Kavanaugh, and that's Doug Jones, who won that special election in Alabama to replace Jeff Sessions. So Kavanaugh almost certainly has 51 votes. It's just a question of, is it 52, 53, 54, 55 or more? And we'll find out soon enough.
Well, we will point out that when then-President Obama nominated justices, now justices, Kagan and Sotomayor, many Republicans, in fact, joined in voting for those confirmations because they felt that although they disagreed with the nominees, they were qualified and the president had a right to appoint them. So it'll be interesting to see how many, if any, Democrats vote here for Kavanaugh. In terms of those red states, Andy, one of the most endangered Democratic U.S. senators is Joe Manchin in West Virginia. Is there a compelling reason for senators like Joe Manchin to, in fact, vote for this, since it appears like it's going to be a positive confirmation vote anyhow?
These red state Democrats who are up for re-election, or like Doug Jones in Alabama, who could face a serious or will face a serious challenge in 2020, their decision on Kavanaugh will be dictated almost exclusively on how it's going to affect their race. Joe Manchin, of course, is running for re-election in West Virginia, which overwhelmingly supported Trump in 2016. So voters are going to be very sensitive to how he votes. He thinks he has a very moderate record and that West Virginians are attracted to that. But in this hyper-partisan time that we live in, I think he cannot risk voting against Kavanaugh if he wants to get reelected. So Manchin, out of all the red state Democrats, I think he's one of the top ones who will likely support Kavanaugh. If memory serves, I believe he supported Gorsuch, so it wouldn't surprise me if he did. Joe Donnelly in Indiana, another red state Democrat, he voted against Gorsuch, as did John Tester in Montana, another red state Democrat who's up for re-election. In this game, it's only two strikes and you're out. So if they vote against Kavanaugh, they're really gambling with their re-election chances. So I wouldn't be surprised if you saw both of those men and Manchin and perhaps a few others vote for Kavanaugh.
In the states that you just referenced, Andy, Montana, Indiana, even West Virginia, the races for Senate seats in those states are very close. A lot of the polling is showing them within the margin of error. There are also a couple of other states, for example, Missouri, and also Heidi Heitkamp, who is in North Dakota. You have Republican challengers actually leading by 4 or 5 points in those states. Is this a vote, especially since it's likely to come by the 1st of October, that is going to become a campaign issue in swing states like that?
Yeah, in fact, it already is. You know, the liberal media is not worth much, but the one thing that they are doing, along with liberal left-wing groups, is that they're hounding these senators saying, how are you going to vote on Kavanaugh? How are you going to vote on Kavanaugh? And they're getting ambushed while they're walking down the halls in the Senate office buildings. And the only thing that these senators can say, which is unfortunate, I'm still looking at it. McCaskill was caught on tape just recently. She thought that Kavanaugh was qualified on paper to be a Supreme Court justice. And that got her into some hot water with left-wing voters and left-wing groups. She did say that she has a 2-point test, and that's just one of them. The other point is a philosophical one, which she says she has not determined yet. So this is the number one issue for these Democrats right now, and their vote is going to be, it's going to sway the electorate, whether it's one percentage point or two percentage points, I don't know, but it's going to be a big deal.
Andy Roth at the Club for Growth. Andy, tell us a bit about the club.
The Club for Growth is a membership organization out of Washington, D.C., but we have over 250,000 members from all across the country, from all walks of life, from all 50 states in the union, and we're united because we believe in economic freedom. If your listeners are interested, they can go to our website at www.clubforgrowth.org, and if they like what they see, they can join for free.
Andy Roth at the Club for Growth. Andy, we'll keep an eye on all these races and check in with you again next week. Thank you.
Thanks for having me, Loman.
The First Amendment right of public employees to not have to join or pay so-called fair share fees to labor unions has been affirmed by the Supreme Court. But some unions are refusing to comply. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine has details.
Back in June, you may recall that the U.S. Supreme Court struck down long-standing precedent by ruling that public sector unions could not force workers to pay dues if those same workers declined to join the union. But as it turns out, seems like many unions haven't gotten the message, and workers in a bunch of states are now having to go to court just to enforce a ruling that's already been decided. Hi, folks. I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine. Thanks for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal. No guest for me this week. Instead, we're taking a look at some of the fallout from the Janus ruling. Yes, that was the case decided by the Supreme Court in June. It was Janus versus the American Federation of County, State, and Municipal Employees. That's AFSCME, one of the largest public sector unions in the country. And that was the case in which Mark Janus, a bookkeeper from Illinois, won his right to stop paying so-called fair share dues into the local chapter of the AFSCME union. And Mark Janus went all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court and won his argument, saying, hey, I don't have to make those payments. I shouldn't have to pay to support a private organization that I disagree with and to which I am not a member. And it was a ruling that made a lot of sense. But as I said, unions don't seem to have gotten the message. The ruling in June significantly reshapes the role that public sector unions play in American politics, or at least it could. So it's pretty difficult to imagine that there were any labor unions out there not watching the outcome of the case. But months later, it seems like a bunch of them either didn't pay attention or just are refusing to learn. Take the Service Employees International Union Local 521, for example. That's a San Jose-based union representing some 40,000 workers in California's Central Valley. It has an exclusive collective bargaining rights contract for workers in the Santa Clara Valley Transportation Authority. And like most unions in the pre-Janus days, its contract requires that workers in the Santa Clara Valley Transportation Authority pay dues even if they choose not to join the union, although non-members do pay that lower cost agency fee instead of the full price of dues. Those agency fee payments, of course, were the centerpiece of the Supreme Court's ruling in Janus, and the court held that the unions can no longer collect those fees. Justice Samuel Alito, in the decision, wrote that public employees are forced to subsidize a union even if they choose not to join and strongly object to the positions that the union takes in collective bargaining and related activities. So, Alito concluded that the court sees that arrangement as a violation of the free speech rights of non-members by compelling them to subsidize private speech on matters of substantial public concern. Yet, for some reason, SEIU Local 521 is still collecting agency fees from its employees or from employees of the local transportation authority. William Howell, for example, has worked for the Santa Clara Valley Transportation Authority since 2005, but refrained from joining the union. And now he is the lead plaintiff in a class action suit seeking to stop the union from collecting those fees without non-members' consent. He also wants a refund of all agency fees previously collected. Those refunds could end up costing the union millions of dollars, according to Patrick Semmons. He's the vice president of the National Right to Work Legal Defense Foundation, which is representing Howe and had previously argued on Mark Janus's behalf in front of the Supreme Court. Now, California state law allows for the collection of mandatory union dues and agency fees, but this new lawsuit argues that the Janus ruling makes California's law and other state-level laws like it unconstitutional. Meanwhile, unions in Oregon and Massachusetts have recently received cease and desist letters from attorneys at the Liberty Justice Center, another law firm that was involved in the Janus case, threatening lawsuits if the unions do not stop deducting fees from paychecks. In both states, the unions have continued taking agency fees because they say that workers consented to joining the union. But the Liberty Justice Center argues that that is a misinterpretation of the Supreme Court's ruling in Janus, which said that workers must clearly and affirmatively consent to making those payments. In other words, any consent based upon an unconstitutional choice was made under duress, not freely given, and is therefore invalid. And in Washington state, we've got six workers who have filed a lawsuit last month saying that they tried to exit the Washington Federation of State Employees after the Janus ruling, but were told by the union that they had to wait until a so-called escape period, which lasts for just 10 days and won't come around again until later next year. The Washington State Attorney General's office claims that the Janus ruling only affects the payment of agency dues by non-members, and that apparently means that unions can lock up current members who want to leave the union under whatever terms they want. But that seems to ignore people like these six workers who are union members who want to become non-members so that they no longer have to pay dues. And of course, the First Amendment should apply year-round. There's no such thing as an exit period for exercising your First Amendment rights. Mike Stone, one of those six plaintiffs, told Fox News recently that he just wants what's right and fair, and the way the union has treated him since the Janus decision is not right or fair. Stone says he doesn't want his money being used to support an organization he disagrees with. And hey, that sounds really familiar. In fact, it sounds a lot like what Alito wrote for the majority in the Janus ruling, saying that public employees are forced to subsidize a union even if they choose not to join it and strongly object to the positions the union takes. No workers should be forced to subsidize a private organization that they disagree with, no matter whether that's a condition of their employment or not. Workers who are in unions should be allowed to leave them if they choose. And of course, if you're out of the union, and this is perhaps news to some public sector unions across the country, you can't keep collecting forced union dues from workers just because they happen to be there. So while the Janus decision was a big victory for workers' rights, it appears that it is far from being the last word in this ongoing battle. For Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Boehm. You can check out our coverage of the Janus case and our coverage of these ongoing court cases, sort of these skirmishes in the aftermath of the Janus decision. You can check all that out at Reason.com. And I'll be back here next week with a guest for another edition of American Radio Journal.
Should everything that happens be about politics? Colin Hanna of Let Freedom Ring USA says it doesn't have to be on this American Radio Journal commentary.
The Kavanaugh hearings have been so boisterous, so contentious, and so irrationally partisan that they are not so much about Brett Kavanaugh's qualifications and suitability for the Supreme Court as they are about our political discourse and us as a nation. They have illuminated how our two-party system is in the process of undermining the very democracy of which the Senate hearings are a part. Has our political polarization become so belligerent and definitive that we are becoming a binary society, one in which we are all in one or the other of two utterly different camps, as mutually incompatible as two different species? This polarization has been fed by the emergence of news media that make no pretense at separating news from opinion. The most notable examples may be Fox News Channel versus MSNBC, but more are proliferating as television and print media increasingly make statements or assertions of fact that are actually rooted in opinion. The New York Times Supreme Court reporter Adam Liptak, on the front page of last Sunday's edition, unquestionably one of the most prestigious and widely read platforms in all of modern media, wrote, and I quote, "Judge Kavanaugh's demeanor was bland and unruffled, and he navigated two marathon days of questioning without revealing anything not already on his long record, one reflecting a slashing partisan background and a deeply conservative judicial record," close quote. Are the terms slashing partisan background and deeply conservative in the realm of factual reporting or personal opinion? Liptak went on to say, quote, His mild affect and canned paeans to the rule of law masked the importance of the moment. His confirmation would represent the culmination of a decades-long project of the conservative legal movement, one that would supply the fifth vote needed to put it in firm and lasting control of the Supreme Court. There was a circular quality to the proceedings that might have been amusing in different times, close quote. The sarcasm in those sentences is almost palpable. Even his use of the rather obscure word paean, which means a song of praise, is subtly sarcastic, but the comment that the proceedings might have been amusing in different times unmistakably implies that the writer doesn't believe him. Again, the question is whether such comments are properly within the province of factual journalism or personal opinion. The always controversial subject abortion is again in the center of the hearings on Judge Kavanaugh. And similar to the New York Times' willingness to abandon the standards of journalism to sway its readers into opposing Kavanaugh if they weren't already there, some of the senators in the all-important Senate Judiciary Committee willingly suspend standards of both Senate decorum and intellectual integrity to discredit the nominee. Senator Kamala Harris, reportedly an aspiring presidential candidate, who is understandably using the hearings as an opportunity for national exposure, claimed that Judge Kavanaugh had referred to certain drugs mandated by the Affordable Care Act as abortion-inducing. What he did was, quote, one of the plaintiffs in the case making that claim, thus clearly distinguishing them from his personal views. It turns out that the video of Kavanaugh that Senator Harris played edited out Judge Kavanaugh's quotation that clearly identified the contention as that of a plaintiff, not of the judge. The dishonesty of that maneuver was so egregious that the Washington Post gave her four Pinocchios, its harshest measure of lying. This binary, politically polarized division of our culture is taking place in venues that you'd think would have little to do with politics. Actor Kevin Sorbo returned his Nike shoes to the company because it selected Colin Kaepernick as a spokesman for the brand. And the selection of Kaepernick himself was intentionally political and divisive. I don't think that was a wise choice, but I wouldn't take it out on my sneakers. Singer Willie Nelson was protested by fans in Texas because he came out in support of Senate candidate Beto O'Rourke. I wish he hadn't, and I think it was unwise for him to do so from a business standpoint. But I wouldn't refuse to go to a Willie Nelson concert because of it. Not everything is political. Not everything in our country should be seen from the perspective of supporting or opposing Donald Trump. Why must we always be at each other's throats? I'm a Philadelphia Eagles fan. Why do some of my team's players insist on making a political statement when the national anthem is played before games? Lighten up, America. This has been Colin Hanna of Let Freedom Ring for American Radio Journal. Visit us on the web at letfreedomringusa.com.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country, including WLSHAM in Lansford, Pennsylvania, WRSKLP in Newton, New Jersey, along with WERGFM in Erie, Pennsylvania. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on this program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.